Welcome to Season 3, Episode 18 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk a little bit about playing heroic monsters. We talk some about curses. And finally, we dive into the topic of how to train your dungeon master or game master, depending on your flavor. Again, welcome to Season 3, Episode 18 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff. And joining me this week is Marshall from Division Nihil. Did I pronounce that right?
Nihil? Yes, you did.
Okay. I'm never sure. And Brian from StufferShack.com. Welcome, gentlemen. Welcome back to the show. I'm glad you guys could both make it.
Always.
Always a good time.
Yeah, so anything exciting before we hit the news?
Not for me.
Why do I even ask?
I don't know.
I don't know. I always expect something more interesting, like, yeah, I did this. It's like, wait a minute. But that wouldn't be, of course, relating to RPGs or the topics of the day. So why don't we go ahead and hit the news and play this, well, nasty bumper that I need to get replaced. So again, people listening out there, I really would like some suggestions for a new bumper. Caveat, of course, is it has to be something that's free or Creative Commons, and that's important because, believe it or not, we just can't use any music we like because it's illegal.
It's frowned upon. Illegal things.
Makes the policeman flustered and stern.
Okay, well, actually kind of first up is, of course, one of my favorite topics, Gen Con. Gen Con apparently signed a deal with the True Dungeon folks for 4 more years. And they promise next year, which is 2012. God, that seems weird saying 2012, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That it will be larger and there will be more tickets for the event. So that's kind of I really never gotten into... Both years that I've gone, I've seen it. It just wasn't my thing. But so it's out there, which is kind of cool. We have for those of you who don't know what True Dungeon is, we are going to include in the show notes a link to the True Dungeon homepage, which is kind of cool. I don't know how either one of you guys ever been to Gen Con and or done a True Dungeon event before.
I have not done True Dungeon. It actually doesn't appeal to me that much.
Yeah, I actually think that True Dungeon, just my personal opinion, kind of appeals to people a little bit more on the LARPer side or those that kind of, I don't know, I don't know how to describe it. I know they have puzzles and weird things that you have to do in their little True Dungeon thing, so it's not just for LARPers, but I kind of get the impression that people who like to do kind of lean more towards the LARPers tend to like it better than, well, me, who's just more of a straight pencil and paper person. However, it's cool that it's there. It's cool that people who like to do that can do that there.
No, it's very different.
Yeah. I know that they have tokens or something. I don't know how that works.
Yes.
So, you know, I know people, you know, I've run across people that, you know, I guess boast about the tokens that they've gotten.
Right.
So, and of course...
One thing I'm curious about with them saying that they're going to have more tickets, one of the things that I heard in a lot of the Gen Con recaps that I listened to, people who went through True Dungeon this year said that it was actually not as good because they were doing larger groups going through.
Oh,
it
really?
Used to generally, it used to be like 6 people would go through at a time, and this year it was up to 10, except they would never really cap it off. So if a group of 3 showed up and that bumped you up to 12, they would just let them go ahead and join in.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, when you're trying to solve puzzles and you have 12 people who mostly don't know each other,
that
trying
can get
to
a little
together,
technically hard, yeah.
And everything was on a strict time limit because they're just moving people through the system.
Well, I think that's kind of maybe why they wanted to make it larger. So I don't know. It'll be interesting.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how 2012 pans out.
Yep.
So that's kind of interesting. Another piece of news that I ran across was Frog God Games announced. I don't even know how to pronounce this. The Rapan Athuk. Does anyone know how to actually pronounce that? I don't know. They're going to release it for Pathfinder. And they're going to expand it from 36 levels to 50. This is one of the, I guess, early mega dungeons that mm-hmm. was done. And it's like, okay, I don't even know if I want to do 50 levels of anything.
Yeah.
Bill Webb, the quote from him says that the book will be available for pre-order in March or April of 2012. Retail price and page count are still to be determined, although the running suggestion for that, I guess, is probably going to be over $100 and going to be like 1,000 pages or so.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that the pre-order copies will contain bonus material as a PDF that were cut from the final manuscript and will not be available after the pre-order period ends.
Huh.
It's like, okay, I guess that's kind of cool. I just don't know. Personally, I can't even imagine spending, you know, over $100 on a dungeon. Yeah, I don't care if it is a mega dungeon right now. That's a little much for me. I can't even imagine doing 50 levels of a dungeon.
Well, it reminds me of Monty Cook's product, which I don't know how to pronounce, the Ptolus?
Ptolus.
The giant fantasy city that he produced, which is just like, what is this, like 500 pages, something like that.
I don't remember because it was originally, one volume and then split to two, or the other way around?
I don't know. Yeah. I know he's done more than one version of it, and I know it's ungodly large.
It's huge. It has gorgeous maps. I mean, it has really high production value.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was never interested in plunking down over $100 for a setting.
Exactly. It's another product. And it's just one city. He's just detailed it out the eyeballs where it's over $100. And it's like, I'd love to own that, but I would also love to own an oil field.
Exactly. Or, you know, we'd all like to have trust funds so we have money coming in all the time. So there we go. So an interesting little news is Wired.com had a list of the top essential geek must-read books. Mm-hmm. And guess what was number one?
I read it.
Of course. I mean, anyone who's been in this thing a long time. But the AD&D DMG, first edition DMG, Dungeon Master's Guide. That was kind of weird.
Very interesting.
And it was interesting because the other nine, the other ones on the list, number one was the AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide. Number two was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Number three was Watchmen.
Yep. Things you expect from these lists.
Right. Number four was Gödel, Escher, and Bach. I don't even know if I pronounced that right.
It's Gödel.
Gödel. I'm sorry. Like I said, I can't pronounce half these things. Yeah. Number five was Ender's Game. Number six was Snow Crash.
Yep.
Number seven was Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings was lower on the list than the DMG. You know, Lord of the Rings is in Appendix N in the DMG, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what their criteria were.
I don't know. I think this was just one guy's opinion, but it was interesting. Number eight was the visual display of quantitative information.
Yep.
You know, actually, you laugh at that, but I actually looked it up and I said, you know, that's actually kind of interesting. I might actually have to buy a copy of that and read.
It's a fantastic book, and you will never look at graphics in the newspaper the same way again, ever. I mean, it really will change the way you look at how data is displayed.
Well, you know, honestly, after taking my getting my master's degree in GIS, I don't look at maps the same way again. So,
right, this does much the same thing for graphs. So. You will look at so much stuff that's printed in USA Today, and you will go, "You are lying," even though your numbers are correct. The way you are displaying them is being deliberately it's deliberate misinformation.
You know, the same thing happens in maps, by the way.
Yeah.
Big time. Especially the maps where they display like quantitative information, actually.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and number nine, we're going to go on. Number nine was Neuromancer. So I'm looking at this list and like, wow, the DMG really, they claim it really rates. And you know, it's the one book I still have a copy of. It's a crappy mm-hmm. copy. I wish I had a better copy. And it's the one thing that I really wish I had in PDF format. Or I don't care if it was even in PDF format. I wish it was in an ebook format of some sort.
Right. Sure.
You know, take your pick. I don't care what you do. But not going to happen. Interesting. last week, Monty Cook's been doing the Wizards Legends and Lore column.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And last week he had a little musing on preserving past monsters. And there was a survey at the end. And the results were in this week's, you know, Legends and Lore column. And apparently, 70% of the people who actually took that little poll thought that, yes, it was very important to preserve, you know, past monsters that were published. You know, it was actually an interesting read. I mean, I'm including it in the show notes. The only reason I bring it up in the news because I thought it was very interesting because especially I noticed a lot of his columns that he's been writing for this Legends and Lore thing are very, it does lead more credence to the fact that they are going to do a fifth edition.
Oh, absolutely. Almost yeah. Everything he's written since he started writing that column has been reexamining a major part of the game and how it's been done, how it could possibly be done, and then trying to see how people respond to that. So we know what he's thinking about.
Yeah, exactly. Another interesting, this one's a little interesting, is CCP Games had a 20% layoff worldwide, and it's unknown how this is actually going to affect basically Vampire the Masquerade, because White Wolf Publishing is under that group.
Yep,
right.
So the word is that no, I guess at least a couple of the major people that people know about, they still have their jobs right now. So,
yeah,
it's been very difficult to get like clear information on it, though. I mean, I don't understand that they're a private company, but still,
I know that Eddie Webb, who is one of their main guys there, still has his job, but his wife, who also worked for White Wolf, was laid off.
Okay,
so. At this point, those are the only names that I've heard any information on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess CCP Games also does a bunch of video games online.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're only online games.
Yeah, so. their primary moneymaker is Eve Online, which is a very different sort of MMO with a lot of economics involved, and it's a very reactive world. Right, it's not all about going and beating up the monsters, and they're trying to develop a stable of MMOs that function the same way.
I mean, is that why they have the White Wolf title?
Yes, they eventually want to. They have in the works a World of Darkness MMO that functions similarly to EVE Online in that it will be a very political game, some sort of supernatural economics. They're really hush-hush on the details. But where rather than, you know, getting online and going out and finding vampires to beat up or anything like that, you'll be creating your coterie and building it up and making deals with other coteries and whatnot.
Okay. Well, you know, more power to them if they can do it. That doesn't sound anything interesting to me, but that's just me.
Yeah.
You know, other people have different priorities or different interests. And that's what's right. So, honestly, that's why I think gaming, no matter what kind of gamer you are, whether you video gamer, RPG gamer, tabletop gamer, card gamer, you know, that's what makes, I like using the generic title of gamer, generally right. speaking. I really, yep. because, you know, it's like, I do a little bit of video games, not as much as I used to. I'm a serious RPG gamer, but I do war games. I do the Euro games and all this other stuff. So I really hate it when people say, I'm just an RPG. No, you're not. Get over yourself. You know, some of them may be, but, you know, I know a lot of people that cross over. So it's like, I hate it when it's just, I don't know. That's just me. I'm digressing. So next up, though, the last one item on the news docket was pointed out to me was this gentleman, Brent Newhall is working mm-hmm. on a Spelljammer. He doesn't want to call it a clone, so I'm calling it a like setting called Void Jumpers. I guess he has something out there already in PDF format.
Yep. Just I think this morning he finally put out the PDF. He's been working on it for a little while. That's got pretty much enough rules to get you going if you already have the 4E core books.
Right. And I forgot to mention it is for 4th edition. Thank
yep.
you.
You know, because Spelljammer never got updated for 3rd edition. It doesn't look like it's going to get updated to 4th edition. But there's still a lot of people who remember it very well, who are still gaming. And so he's trying to update as much of a number of very similar mechanics, so you can recreate that feel, which I think is great because I love that stuff. You know, orcs in space just fantastic to me.
Well, I mean, I give him credit for trying something, and at least what I like is his dictate that he's not trying to just make Spelljammer with the serial numbers filed off.
Yep.
So.
Yep. And at least right now, he's not trying to sell it either. He is taking donations on his site, and he's got like a 60-page document, which is pretty good quality PDF available for the taking. But he's,
you know, he actually did some layout on it. I like I said, I don't really never really like Spelljammer. I mm-hmm. don't really do 4th edition, but I wanted to just click on it, take a look through it. And yeah, he did a real simple, he did a pretty decent basic layout for it. So that was kind of nice.
Yep.
So. Okay, well, I think that's all for the news, unless you guys have any last-minute news items that no one told me about.
Well, actually, I have one thing that I want to encourage our listeners to check out, is that our very own Mark Meredith, yesterday on Twitter, invented a complete RPG on Twitter.
Yeah?
It's called Awesome Sauce, and it's like Rhysis, only it's lighter, because you only have one stat that's called Awesome Sauce. And you have an awesome sauce rating that starts at 1. And if you want to test against something else, you roll a number of D6 equal to your awesome sauce. It rolls a number of D6 equal to its awesome sauce. And whoever wins, wins. And if you describe doing something awesome when you win, your awesome sauce goes up. So that's over at – you can read all the details over at his blog at Dice Monkey. And I ended up creating a bunch of creating most of a fantasy bestiary for him on Twitter yesterday. So,
okay, well, there you go. That's a quick pick for this week, I guess. All right. Well, why don't we get into our topics so we don't kill people on time? Topic one, I guess, this week is we've talked in the past about drows and why they should eat babies, and we're going to kind of have a rebuttal here this week by talking about plain heroic monsters.
Yep, and this is sort of my fault. I'm arguing with myself now because I was the person who said drow need to eat more babies in the first place, but I have to rescind it a little bit, just a little bit. Now, when you asked me earlier in the podcast if anything was up, but one thing I failed to mention because I wanted to talk about it here was Kobold Quarterly 19 just came out. A big fan of Kobold Quarterly mainly because they print for any edition. If you submit them stuff, they're really looking for any system. They print Age, Call of Cthulhu, 3.5, Pathfinder. As long as they think someone wants to read it, and it's good.
Let's face it, when people claim that Kobold Quarterly is the kind of the successor to the old Dragon magazine, they really are.
It absolutely is. I can't think of another magazine that at least covers that audience. You know, they mail it all over the world. Yeah. And I'm proud to say they published one of my articles in this last issue, so you should all go pick it up. You should pick it up, too, because there's only one 4th edition article in it, so you'll like it.
Well, you know, I don't have any objection to 4th edition articles in general. I mean, here's the thing. Like I said, I remember reading Dragon magazine where, you know, you'd have D&D in there and you have Gamworld. Sometimes you'd have a Traveler article thrown in. Sometimes you'd have an article from God knows what. There was fiction. Dragon Man used to be a much different magazine than what it became.
Absolutely.
In the later ages. But that's just my opinion. So, anyway, we are digressing once again, as we often do on this show.
Well, what I ended up writing about was I created new mechanics for 4th edition. I was the one article that let the player play a werewolf and let that transformation extend throughout the first 10 levels of play. One of the things I didn't like with 3rd edition is if you wanted to play something monstrous that wasn't really simple, it had a very large level adjustment, where it basically, until a later book changed the rules, you couldn't play that race until you were level 4, level 8. You know, you had to make up for it in power. And it always felt strange to me that there wasn't some way to do that, because there's got to be, you know, a half-orc starting out somewhere, or, well, not a half, that's a bad example, but a giant starting out somewhere. And as I was writing this article, I got, you know, really excited about this idea of, you know, being able to play this classic werewolf. And then, of course, I thought about drow eating babies and how I don't want people to play the sissy drow anymore. So it's really a bit of a conflict now, isn't it? Because in a lot of ways, there's some really great merit to being able to play this redeemable monster. But I still, in my heart of hearts, want there to be these evil, evil races. But I think some of the classic monsters really aren't those. You know, the drow, when they were first written, at least to my knowledge, were written to be these evil bad guys. But even when you look at early werewolf stuff in popular culture, they were the afflicted. You know, they were these normal guys who were being beat upon by the outside, but weren't really the bad guys. They just didn't have control. And I think there's a lot of races that you can play like that as long as it doesn't become every other character.
Well, what kind of races were you thinking, besides the werewolf? I mean,
obviously, the werewolf was my example. When you think about races that are not really races, that are afflictions, the next thing that comes up is the vampire. And I actually don't feel this way about the vampire. When I think of the vampire, I think of somebody who's been sort of overwhelmed with evil. I don't really subscribe to the sparkling vampire or the Buffy vampire. I don't...
Or the Forever Night vampire, or whatever you want to call.
Yeah, you know. And there's been lots of systems that let you play the conflicted vampire. But that's... And that's cool, but that's not what comes in my head. I think of, I've been bitten, and now I'm this bad guy. And I'm cool with that. Like I said, I like evil races that are evil. But, for example, the half-orc. You know, no one's ever really considered, since the half-orc's been a playable race, that these people might just always be evil, but obviously they're this sort of shunned race. Or even the half-elf, even by Tolkien standards, you know, these were these in-between people that, you know, weren't really respected anywhere.
And, well, you know, it's interesting that stuff like that doesn't come up in play very often. It's like everyone says, oh, you're a half-elf. Okay, no big deal.
Yeah,
but as you point out in like the Tolkien literature, yeah, they were kind of like, you're not really us and you're not really human. And they do describe that a lot of times in the game texts.
Yeah, a little bit. But,
you know, but we've kind of.
But you don't want to like have mechanics for shunning in most games, because you never want to make the player feel like.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It is interesting though, because if you go to. I think the first edition Player's Handbook, if memory serves me right, there was, or was it the DMG? I forget which. There actually was, you know, race versus race, like outlook modifiers or whatever for that stuff.
Sure.
And that was interesting because, you know, I think as modern gamers, we kind of frown upon that. And I think a lot of that has to do just with the fact that sometimes we don't want to consider the fact that, generally speaking, in societies tend to, if you're not us, then we may not want to deal with you at some level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like, let's face it, we don't like to talk about the possibility of some form of, you know, social racism of some sort, of any sort.
Sure.
So, but the truth is that, you know, culturally we do that against each other, and that's horrible, but it's true.
Yeah.
So
I know at my home games, we absolutely play that up, but I have a very mature group.
Right.
If you choose to play the drow, people are going to be racist against you. In fact, depending on where you go, they're going to be, you know, biased against you based on your sex. You know, like I don't leave that alone. It's something that we play with. But if you were going to write that into a game setting or a mechanic, all of a sudden you've got a sticker on the front of your book that says, you know, for mature players, and that can be a major turnoff for people, so I understand why they don't do it.
No, I mean, I understand, too. I mean, a lot of it just has to do with audience and sell. You know, honestly, let's face it, game producers are wanting to sell a product, and they can't do that if if that product is going to offend a large chunk of people.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's not just about offending. It's about the fact that there actually are an awful lot of players out there that cannot handle these topics well.
That's probably true. I will not disagree with you there.
I think there is a subset.
I wouldn't
dare try to quantify a number, but yes, there is a subset.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
You know, but then again, I mean, that's kind of why we all play different games.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, but I mean, so, you know, you're arguing, of course, that, you know, obviously there's, you know, so heroic monsters. You know, what's interesting when you brought up the half-orc is I actually do remember, I don't know if it was a half, it wasn't necessarily the half-orc, but I do remember in one of the Dragon magazines, there was a piece of fiction that involved like this orc cleric, and you know the whole, you know, he's trying to sacrifice himself to, you know, it was kind of a strange thing. It's like he was willing to take the blame for things that he didn't do because he realized, you know, there was this whole heroic bent to it.
Sure.
You know, I don't. It's funny, I don't remember the exact story, but I remember that happened, and he was a cleric, and, you know, some people are like, really, you're an orc, and you're a cleric of this particular deity? Why would you worship this deity? You're an orc, kind of thing. So, I mean, and that kind of gets into that mold, I think, is what you're talking about. You know, and that's the thing. It's like, I don't think, while I prefer evil things to be evil, generally speaking, you know, every once in a while, if there's an aberration, it's not a big deal. The problem, I think, that we run into is where all of a sudden the aberration becomes the norm.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's, I think, where we have problems. You know, it's like, and I think that's the problem, of course, with the whole vampire trying to redeem himself comes from. Is that we've seen that. We've done that so often. And, you know,
it's just been too much.
I mean, in some cases, you know, in some cases, vampires aren't even bad people at all. And you're just like, really? I don't get that.
Yes.
Know, if you require human blood, I don't get how you can't be at least a questionable person at some level.
Sure.
So, you know, it's just, that's kind of where that whole, you know, it's just, I don't get that. But, we, you know, that's what happens is that, you know, and, you know, if you really took a look at a lot of the classic monsters, it's like, it would be very interesting. I don't know if you could do it, but, you know, let's face it, the infamous flesh golem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a template from basically Frankenstein, if you really get that. Yeah. You know, and, you know, their Frankenstein's monster was, if you really want to get technical, was that tortured soul kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Childlike sometimes, depending on the depiction. So, I mean, that in itself is very interesting. And, you know, that would be a very interesting, it would take a very special gamer to pull off running or playing that particular character.
Absolutely. It would be very difficult.
You know, because I could see where that could go horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even golems in general. I mean, let's face it, the infamous clay golem, where does that come from?
Rabbi Lo.
There you go. Exactly. It's actually, you know, and so, you know, you could see where that could possibly even be, you know, I could possibly, it's kind of like in a lot of science fiction settings, robots. Robots kind of occupy that weird area where they can be good or bad depending, but it takes a very special player to pull off those type of characters because the demands of that particular, you know, I don't know, character interpretation, you know, makes.
Yeah.
It also takes the right group because looking at the different shades of emotion and theme and whatnot that come from exploring humanity or morality or whatever, it requires a lot of spotlight time. And it requires that the story that you're going through forces you to confront those aspects of yourself, which means that the story then becomes, at least for one particular arc, revolves around that character. And some groups are going to be good with letting that spotlight revolve around in order to have each person really get developed and are going to be good with working with the other people to help develop their characters. Some groups are not. Some groups do not want that much thought in their games. You know, they're here to roll a few dice and kill a few orcs. And some people aren't that good with sharing the spotlight.
So, yeah, I mean, again, like you said, a lot of this type of, you know, thing does require a group that's willing to kind of go beyond the norm. And unfortunately, that takes time, and sometimes you have to feel out your group. You can't, like, just form a new group and automatically assume you can do this.
Yes.
So, well, any closing comments on this particular topic before we go to the next?
You should buy everything that has my name on it.
Okay, you know, I'll check my bank account. I don't think that's possible for me right now. So, but there you go. Obviously, you know, there's the what issue number for Kobold Quarterly?
That's Kobold Quarterly 19. Just came out last week.
And for those of you wondering, they do have PDF versions of that thing as well, which is kind of cool.
They do. I think it's only just under $5 for the PDF version.
Exactly. So you can, and we should mention that. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they used to all. I'm sure they still do. I have to check the homepage. If you prefer to support our troops, you can actually buy money to send our troops Kobold Quarterly stuff.
They do. They've got I can't think of the name of it now that you're talking about it. But you can basically buy a subscription to the magazine for the people overseas, because it's one of the things that's easy to, you know, because it's just a magazine. It's easy to mail over there.
Exactly.
And it provides enough content that usually it's, as long as they know the systems well enough, you know, they've sent some of the letters back in, you can read them. It's pretty, it's pretty big stuff. People seem to really appreciate it.
Yeah. And, I won't lie, as a former military person myself, I understand that. So I think that's a pretty cool thing that they do.
Very cool.
I actually kind of wish more companies would do something similar. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, so anyway, I know that several other people have tried, but apparently there's actually a lot of
bureaucracy.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know the bureaucracy about it. I just know that when I was in the military, I don't know. I know that we did get stuff from various places at various times. So I'm sure there is a bureaucracy. It's just, I think you just have to have the wherewithal to and the fortitude to actually outlast the system.
Sure. So. And obviously, it can be done.
Yeah, actually, you know, my topic, which is coming up next, is curses, and it kind of feeds a little bit when I get into it. It kind of feeds a little bit off of your topic when you're talking about heroic monsters and the conflicted. But you know, one of the things that I've really hated about curses, especially like in third edition, second edition, first edition, D&D, you know, Pathfinder. Is, you know, if you look at the classic mythology and fantasy, you know, there's all these curses which are kind of the mainstay of their stories, but curses don't quite work that way in most of the game systems. And, you know, it's interesting because while I was thinking about this today, one of the things I realized was that a lot of the things that we take for granted as curses, in many cases, is usually completely other spells than what we think a curse is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a lot of the classic curses, which is like, you know, they're turned into some other creature. That's like some sort of polymorph other spell or something.
Right.
You know, or, you know, even just some of the weird classic curses, you know, where it's like curses don't work, like there's a curse and there's a way to break the curse.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost like we have like, oh, it's remove curse, okay. But it's weird because it's like if you've ever read some of the material that's out there, you know, like some of the game adventures, there's like creatures that have been transformed as part of a curse, and they can break the curse only if like the players solve this puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're like, that's great. That's outstanding. There's no way outside of basically a game master, you know, just calling it that, there's no way to really do that in most of the rules. You know, you just can't, you know, a player character can't curse somebody and says, oh, this will be broken when you do X.
Oh, no, of course not. It's NPC powers.
Well, I mean, it's not even NPC powers. I mean, it's almost like it's really in the realm of divine. But
well, I'll say that it does not work with the D&D magic system.
Well, that's... Again,
there are other RPGs where you can set up that kind of curse pretty easily.
But no,
I've got one that I'm working on where I'm looking very specifically at implementing that kind of curse.
Right. But I mean, I guess my point is that even in the D&D system, a lot of the things that we think of as curses really fall under different areas. Yes. You know.
Sure, sure.
You know, because it's like I was just thinking, like, you know, if you look at some classic curses and like, or not even classic curses, just some curses from various, you know, media, like let's take movies. We have, like, you ever see Warlock?
That's the one with Julian Sands.
Yes.
But, yes.
You know, and he curses the one woman with aging, and she like ages like 10 years every day or something bizarre like that.
Yes.
You know, there's that. That's an interesting curse. You can't really do that. And there was a way to break it, which is to recover that which he took. And you know, I think in one case he blinds somebody, you know, kind of as a curse. And it's interesting because those things could happen in most fantasy games, but they're really other spells.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Even, you know, and I mean, and it's interesting, like in 3.5 and Pathfinder, their bestow curse just has like mechanical effects. But it's really up to the players to actually give it some sort of flavor, if you will.
Sure,
right.
Because, I mean, in 3.5 Pathfinder, it's like -6 to an attribute. Or, you know, like -4 to like attack rolls and saves or something like that. And
right.
there's some other one. And there's actually written descriptions that says other things can be, you know, you can create something all on your own, but it has to fall within those power guidelines. And it's like, well, that's great. I think most game masters, A, would feel uncomfortable doing that typically, just because, you know, well, how powerful really is something?
Sure.
But, you know, so it would be interesting to, you know, see what, you know, I think, and if you're going to use something like that, let's see, I'd like to have the players provide some sort of flavor. Well, why is it -6 to the guy's intelligence?
Yep.
You know, why is it -6 to the guy's charisma? You know, that kind of thing. Is it like, well...
Which I think is good practice anyway. Whenever you've got something that it's not specifically clear, or even if there is flavor text but doesn't necessarily meet the character, that's something I do at my game table all the time, is sometimes you have to say, okay, but why does this happen? Just to keep things moving in a role-playing scenario.
Yeah, I mean...
Shouldn't be any different for curses, yeah.
No, right. And I mean, and actually, in Magic in general, I think in D&D, it's like, you know, we all... I don't know. It's interesting because, you know, there are descriptions of the spells, but it's like, really, does every, you know, let's face it, you know, like, especially spells that are like cross classes,
mm-hmm.
you know, why would they look the same?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, or especially divine magic. Wouldn't the divine magic be semi-representative more of whatever your patron deity is?
Yes. Absolutely. I had a... Go ahead.
Yeah, there have been a dozen articles over the years about how to... add more flavor to the magic
mm-hmm.
in different ways.
So, but I mean, you are right though. The actual style of magic in D&D doesn't really fit, and I think some of it also has to do with the general power of curses. You know, you kind of, you know, in D&D and Pathfinder, it's like a third level spell, I believe.
Yep.
So yes. You know, it's like, okay, well, what, you know, what else is at that level? Things like for the wizard, it's like fireball. And lightning mm-hmm. bolt. It's like, okay, you know. I mean, they're powerful, but how powerful is that?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, they're talking about, you know, minor temporary setbacks, not like the big curses like we think about when we think about epics.
Right. And I think, again, like I said, that's part of the problem. And the other problem, of course, is that a lot of the epic curses that we mention really, in many cases, are really not curses, but rather transformations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I said, this is where I was getting into with, like, you know, when you were mentioning about werewolves and being afflicted, it's like, yeah, that can be like there are werewolf, you know, were creature type curses that some people can be considered to be under, you know, where that yep. actually is a curse rather than, you know, so there's that affliction kind of thing with the curse.
Well, even in 3.5, that's what they referred to lycanthropy as. If you were afflicted with lycanthropy, it was the curse of lycanthropy, and it had its own special rules, but it was referred to as a curse.
Well, I think that's because culturally we consider it a curse.
Sure, sure. But and what it makes me think of when you were mentioning the different types of curses you've seen in other media is the Oracle class in Pathfinder, who I can't remember what they call it. They may even call it a curse. Every Oracle has a major setback. There are these, for those of you who don't know Oracles that well, they're divine casters, kind of like clerics, but they're not, you know, battle hardened. They're more divination based in a way. You know, they're more closer to a witch than they are a priest. And every single one of them has a major setback, with which both gets worse and better as things progress. So, for example, you can start at level 1 and be blind, which is a major setback for a PC. And as you progress through the levels, sure, you're still blind, but you develop the sixth sense as well. It's very cool. I wish more games would have creative mechanics like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, that's... Yeah, I understand what you're saying, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just one of those things. The only reason I even bring up the concept of curses and stuff is obviously, you know, this is actually going to go out right before, you know, Halloween is coming up soon. So
we have a very spooky episode.
I don't think it's that spooky, but, you know, that's kind of what made me think about this because, you know, obviously there's Halloween and there's the concept of witches and witchcraft and, you know, that's always and spirits and other unusual creatures. So... Yeah, I'm kind of done with this topic. Is there anything else we need to add before we move on? Or are we good?
I'm good.
One other thing I wanted to just say is that one of the things you mentioned earlier was that when you're doing the curses, a lot of the curses in fairy tales and whatnot have very specific criteria that must be met to break the curse. And what I've been looking at is how to set up that kind of criteria in a game so that when somebody casts Bestow Curse, they say, this will last until you climb to the top of the Mountain of the Moon. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, that most PCs would say something crazy like that, that clearly nobody could ever fulfill that condition, and therefore the curse is effectively permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I said was that when you look at the stuff in the fairy tales, you always see an interesting thing where the universe seems to twist itself to allow those conditions to technically be fulfilled. So you would end up finding some noble's estate somewhere that was called the Mountain of the Moon. And all you have to do is go there, and the curse is broken.
Well, I was just thinking of Macbeth.
Yes.
You know, it's like, you know, the thing with the forest.
Right, yeah.
I'm sorry, my Macbeth is a little fuzzy, but I remember...
Yeah, when Burnham Wood marches on, I forget the name of his castle.
Yeah. And there's just like, yeah, really? No.
Right.
You know, it's like...
Exactly.
It's almost whimsical. It's like, wait a minute, that would never happen, and... Lo and behold, there's a way that it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the end of Stardust by Neil Gaiman has a great one where it was when Wednesday becomes Monday. I think so.
Something like that.
Yeah, and it turns out to be fulfilled because a girl whose name is Wednesday marries a guy whose last name is Monday, and therefore Wednesday becomes Monday, and the curse is broken.
So yeah, you know, I guess in that realm you have to make it yeah, so it's possible. Yeah, so that's
yes.
That's kind of an interesting thing to think about. So all right, well, I think we're going to move on to our final topic, which is how players can help train their DM.
Yep. And I'm going to make a bit of a confession here in that I don't actually have an answer for this one. I'm mostly looking for input from people because it's a question I've been struggling with.
You know,
so,
you know, that's actually an interesting question. It's like, how can players help? You know, I think, I guess it depends. I mean, if it's the first time a game master has ever played, you know, game mastered, and I don't know, it kind of goes in a couple of different areas for me. It's like right.
I'm looking at with it is that the three of us, most of our listeners out there, we're experienced being a GM.
I was about to say kind of a mentor role is what I was right. thinking.
And even if we don't have that many years behind the screen, we are generally, because you're listening to a podcast on gaming, you probably have read a number of blogs on gaming. You've read articles in Dragon and whatnot. You've absorbed a lot of these tips on how to game. And you find yourself at a table under a GM who either doesn't have a lot of experience or isn't into the hobby enough to read a lot of those how to be a better GM articles out there. And you notice some rough bits around the edges in how they're playing. They aren't engaging the other players really well. They aren't role playing in possibly the best possible way, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I will say that right off the top, there are a couple of basic solutions to this. The first one always is talk it out. Whenever you have any problem of any sort at the table, your number one go-to solution has to be talk it out. Go to your DM, talk to him about it, offer to show him some articles, offer to talk to him about particular things that are going on, etc. Assuming that that doesn't solve the problem for whatever reason, another option is you can simply leave the game.
I typically find that's not a good option unless
it's kind of a nuclear option. But on the other hand, don't necessarily feel like you have to stick it out for some reason.
Oh no.
It may just be that your style of playing and this GM's style of playing aren't compatible.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Trust me, I've left more than one horrible game.
Yeah. So don't necessarily be afraid to do that, but what I'm kind of talking about here isn't the kind of situation where you want to go for that, you know, oh my God, I would rather be cleaning the bathroom than standing here in this game at this point. I'm talking more about just you feel like there are ways that you could – that things could be going better.
Well, I mean
– and when you're behind the screen, you've got a lot of tools to help your players be better players. You can give them in-system bennies like Fate Points or Savage World bennies or whatnot.
Right.
Or even just +2 here and there for good descriptions.
Or extra XP or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, exactly.
You're talking
and
about rewards.
You can have your NPCs role play in a way that you want to see your players role play. And there are hundreds of articles on how to do this as a GM. But I haven't seen very much that's the other way around, and I'm not sure what tools a player has to help convince the GM to engage better, to move the spotlight around better,
to role play better.
Well, I mean, I guess it kind of varies. One is, I mean, even as a player, if you're going to try to train your dungeon master of some sort, it's always the whole lead by example thing. Usually, again, you know, especially when you're talking about role playing, it's like you kind of have to try to engage him if that's what you're trying to help him explore. You kind of have to try to push the role-playing element sometimes. And that might be tough because obviously you have to be in a group where that's what they want as well. Because that kind of gets into a sticking point. It's like if you're the only one interested in doing something and the rest of the group isn't, there's no way the game master can be pressured into – I don't even want to use the word pressure. I'm going to use the word led.
Okay.
Because I don't want to sound like we're just, oh, you're going to do everything the way we say it, do it, you know. No, I mean, and again, though, I mean, that's what I'm saying. You kind of want to lead, you know, you kind of want to lead by example, you know. And, of course, there's always the, you know, and it depends on what the game master needs. Like, you know, like you said, you're talking about training your game master. One of the big things, especially with a young game master is and I know some people take offense to this just because they're rule Nazis, is a lot of early game masters will be like, I just don't know the rule. What I need to look this up. And that's where you can kind of train them into saying, well, you want to just make up something for now and look it up later.
Right.
You know, because I'm a big fan of that. It's like, if I can't find a rule, screw it. I'm just going to make up something on the spot. We'll worry about it later. And some players really take offense to that. And it's like, what are you talking about? Let's move the game along. You know, the other thing, of course, is, you know, you can try, you know how you have argumentative players with game masters?
Yes.
And, you know, that might slow down the game. And sometimes it's just even a matter of training your other players to help, you know, to not be a bastard to the game master in a way, because they're inexperienced. And also be supportive. It's like, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, you got to be supportive of your game master, even if it's after the session. Because it's like,
yes,
let's face it, a game master who doesn't hear, well, you know, there were some good aspects to that game. You know, there might have been some horrible ones, but if there were some good ones, you want to make sure that they you thought that, you know, because if they don't, they're not going to continue.
Yeah,
right.
And I mean, and people might be wondering, well, why you mention that in training your game master? Well, they don't get, you know, as a game master, you don't get experience game mastering if you don't continue to game master. Because let's face it, we were all horrible game masters at one point.
It's true.
You know,
it is true.
You know, I've suffered through being a young preteen boy game mastering. So that's been, that was always fun, because that's a completely different style than the style I play today. You know, and that was because I was young and none of us knew how to actually play an RPG. You know, we kind of learning by the seat of our pants, but that was a completely different play style. And you had a completely different group with a completely different group, you know, set of expectations. So, again, like I said, tools to help, you know, lead by example. If you expect something from the game master, you know, even just making suggestions, you know, not in front of the group, but maybe after or before the game, if you have, I don't know, time to talk to the game master, you know.
Yep.
Even,
yeah.
You know, especially, like I said, maybe he's like rolling hit points for creatures or something as they come up. It's like, well, you know, maybe you need some prep, or, you know, maybe you're like, is there, you know, if you're expecting like reference material for the players, you know, it's like, you know, you might ask, is there any reference material I can read? You know, that sometimes it's just a matter of suggestions in a way that doesn't make them feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. I mean, I have this, honestly, I have the same issue with developers. When you have developers who maybe haven't developed a lot, you kind of have to, without just saying, you need to write documentation, you're like, well, you know, you kind of have to cajole them into writing documentation.
Yep.
Without actually offending them, especially with where I work, where we work with people all over the world and they have a different set of cultural standards. Because you can very easily offend them without even knowing you're offending them.
Sure.
And I think the same can be said when you're dealing with, you know, player and game master. It's like, you don't want to, you're trying not to cross over the line where you're being the game master because you want to play. But on the other hand, you want to help the game master become a better game master. And, you know, like you were saying, there's been articles and stuff. You're like, hey, you know, that's another thing you can always suggest is, you know, maybe you have some articles that you think he would, or she, because I'm not going to, you know, whatever sex is the game master. You know, maybe there's some articles you think that she should, especially if, this sounds really weird, especially if they're older magazines that they're never going to have access to.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, hey, you know, there's some really good articles in here from this old magazine that I thought you might find interesting.
Yep.
You know, reading material.
Or if you're worried about being too obvious about it, you could simply say something like, you know, I've been reading X blog and it's really been interesting. It's really gotten me thinking, you know, do you read it? You know, that way you're not putting out the one article that came up this week that you think they need to read, but you're just pointing them in the right direction or in getting them the habit of reading stuff like that. But I've got to back up one of Jeff's earlier points. I think the best thing you can possibly do is positive reinforcement. There's, you know, the game masters don't get a ton out of running the game just for the sake of running the game. It's a lot of work, and some people like that aspect. But one of the best things that'll happen is after a game, when somebody says, you know what was great, you know, when this happened, this was so much fun. I thought that I had a blast. And that leaves a lasting impression. If you emphasize the thing they did right, or the thing, if you want to be a little subversive, that you would rather see more of, that's what they're going to remember. And when they prep for the next game, that's going to be in the back of their head.
All righty. Any other thoughts on that?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Okay, well, you know what? We actually had two written comments in the comment section of the last podcast, you know, blog entry. And I thought, you know, we had an audio comment, but I double checked it, and it was 15 seconds of static air. Okay, no audio comment. But we did get two written comments, and I'm going to read them. The first one was it was labeled from Blur RPG. So Blur RPG, here is your comment. It says, okay, guys, learn your history. AD&D was 77 to 89. BASIC was still being produced in the box set form well into the 90s. And if you're going to call, it's another paragraph, obviously. And if you're going to call going from 24 million to 1.4 million players, in parentheses, customers doing well, then maybe you should need a refresher course in Business 101. Add to that a tie and two wins for Paizo this year in sales and position, and look at the best-selling RPG by the hour at Amazon, usually occupied by the core Paizo rules. I can only assume that since WotC has shot themselves in both feet so much, I guess a bullet to the head is next. As for sales, the market is doing great when you see the hobbyist business is climbing in sales while the industry is slowly dying. The problem is no one wants to acknowledge the tabletop gaming has come full circle. Two guys in a basement can produce and sell a good product again without the need for a massive corporate outlay. There's so much material come out that it has become tough to track it all. Is the age of the $60 600 bay coffee table rulebook coming to an end? Yes, thank God, but the hobby is stronger than it has been since 85. Do some research on the indie/OSR scene, including the OSR appearance in Gen Con this year, where the vendor said it to be in a good mood and that the sales were good, not as good as last year, but still up. And you'll find that Cosmic Black Hole has that over 30% of the fans have disappeared. And I think, next page. And the only thing I can say is, Blur RPG, is that, you know, my dates are a little off. I unfortunately lived through that period of time. And so all my dates that I give are roughly from my memory.
Yeah.
In 1977, I was 6 years old. So let's see, that would put me, that would be first grade for me. Right, yeah, first grade. And I started gaming in the fourth grade, so that puts me like an 81 when I started gaming.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, my dates in that period, and the first actual D&D game that I own, I mean RPG that I owned, was the D&D Basic Red rulebook. I didn't get the box set. Believe it or not, they sold the rules separately as just a rulebook by itself. You didn't have to get the box set. I had that rulebook. That's how
I got the box set.
Right. Well, somebody else bought me the rules.
Right.
I had that rule set, and I had a set of hand-me-down dice from my brothers. That's how I learned how to RPG. So, you know, it's that's the only thing I can say about the dates. You know, we do our best.
Yep.
I'm not sure I understand the 24 million to 1.5 million players.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know where that number's coming from.
After you pointed that out, the fact that we had written comments, I took a look at that today, and I wish I had seen it sooner, because then maybe I could have gotten a reply from Blur, because I'm just very curious where those numbers came from, because those are very specific numbers, and I didn't think we had such numbers, so I'd love to see.
I don't think anyone has those numbers, really.
Well, right. Blur does. They're right there. You wrote them right on the blog.
Well, hopefully he replies back, and maybe this episode or back on the other one, because I'm curious too. And if we find out, we will let everyone know. However, I do understand what he's saying. Where yes, Paizo's actually been doing really well this year.
They absolutely have.
The sales numbers for them have been very positive. Whether or not WotC has shot themselves in both feet and it's going to get a bullet to the head, that's actually opinion. I kind of agree with that opinion, but I still have to say that's not fact. That's opinion.
Of course. So. You know, I mean, when we're using bullet metaphors, that's pretty much always opinion. And, you know, I don't think – I know we talk a lot about Dungeons & Dragons. That happens to be the system that I'm most familiar with. Certainly is one of the systems that we have the most history on.
I think – here's the thing. I think we talk a lot about D&D mostly because for – I'm going to use this generalization, and people can kill me later for this, but I think most RPGers have at least played D&D at some point and therefore have at least some basic familiarity with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I've met gamers that have never played D&D, RPG gamers. Yep. I have.
Sure, but they know about it.
Right. It's
referenceable. And, you know, it's what my group plays right now. I mean, I dip in some other things, mainly online. And especially in the last couple of podcasts when I've been able to be on, like, I'm in the middle of writing a book and it's all Dungeons & Dragons material. So this is what I'm thinking about.
Exactly.
But, you know, I know we do try to dip into other things here and there. I don't want to make it seem like we're ignoring the indie scene. It's like I'm staring at, you know, the New Gods of Mankind on my shelf right now, which I just had to use for something, and there's definitely other things on my shelf as well.
Well, exactly. If you look at my collection, I have, you know, I have Mouse Guard, I have a whole bunch of books from various publishers. I mean, I even have material that some people have told me doesn't exist. No, I actually have this one game called Reichstar. And someone once told me that game never existed. It's like, I have a fucking printed copy. You're telling me it doesn't exist. I saw
a photocopied copy of it. I have a friend who has it.
The funny thing is, it's an interesting concept, but from what I can tell, it's a horrible mechanic game.
Yeah,
it's just horrid in that regard. So, but getting back to his email, not his email, his comment. Yes, the hobbyist section of the community is growing and the industry section is dying. However, there's a problem with that statement and saying that makes us healthy.
Yeah.
You've just described the amateur radio community, which I'm also a member of, and most people in that community would say that pretty much means the industry's dying.
Yeah.
You know,
and
so,
of course, as the industry dies, it means that local game stores are going to die.
Right.
And so then you have a hard time. You don't have a central point for any kind of community to grow.
Well, you know, because he even mentioned there's so much material coming out that it becomes a tough time to track it all. You're right.
Right.
It does.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does someone who might be interested in the hobby even begin to get all that material? I don't know.
Yep.
So, and
also on that point, you may notice, I mean, Fred Hicks has pointed out on from Evil Hat has pointed out several times that for a lot of those hobbyist companies, selling 1,000 units is doing pretty darn well.
Absolutely.
And when you compare that to the kind of things that Paizo and WotC are churning out, you're not really in the same league.
No.
Now, admittedly, there's 1,000 different indie products coming out, each selling 100 to 1,000 copies. Maybe that's comparable. But it means that the hobby is fragmenting.
Yes.
Oh, right. I don't know if that's good or bad, but yeah, you're right. It is fragmented. So, and it's like, don't get me wrong, I like the OSR scene. I don't like some of the people in it.
Yeah, well.
There are some really... I'm sorry to say that there are some people in the OSR community that make you kind of like, I'm going to go hide my head in shame because you just said something really, really insane.
Yes.
You know, but I think that happens in any community. So,
of course.
Yes.
But I do appreciate that he took the time to write us.
And, yes.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I would also disagree that 30% of the fans have disappeared in the OSR scene. I think there's a good portion of the fans that have just disappeared, period.
But on the other hand, I've heard so many people who say, I was into D&D in the 80s. When I got to college, I wanted to date girls, so I stopped playing D&D, which, well, I never quite understood that connection there.
Well,
but with 4th edition, they came back to the hobby.
Yeah, well, you know,
and they like 4th edition.
There's a lot of people that I mean, that's actually an interesting point. We'll make a point here on that, is that, you know, I'm almost 40 years old now. So there were a lot of people early on in the hobby that gamed and then left, and now they're 40 years old again, and, you know, some of their kids are older. They don't have to worry about their kids. They're actually looking for hobbies again. They're like, well, I used to RPG. You know, my brother, who's actually much older than I am, actually started playing Traveler again, and he started playing Traveler with his daughter and his son, and they're like, you know, 19 and 17, respectively, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's just interesting. He's actually using the Little Black Book rules. And they're enjoying that.
That's great.
So that's kind of an interesting, you know, it's like he, well, to make a long story short, he went through a nasty divorce. And so he's divorced and he had time to kill. He was rediscovering his hobbies.
Right.
And that was one of them. It's like, I just never left the hobby. I've had downtime in the hobby, but I've always had my stuff.
Yeah.
So that's kind of made me a difference. So, I mean, I think there can be growth in the hobby. I'm not, I don't want to make the listener sound like I'm thinking that, oh, the hobby's completely dead. But
no.
But when you say there's an upswing in the hobbyist publishing and a downshift in the, you know, the industrial industry, you know, publishers, that isn't exactly a good sign of a healthy. typically,
yeah,
that's not
GM. GM Skarker had quite a rant about that a couple of months ago on his blog about how the industry is dying. The RPG industry is in its death throes at this point.
I don't know.
Several people came back and said, "But there's so much new material coming out on Drive-Thru all the time." And he's like, "That's not the industry."
Yeah.
And when you are somebody who is attempting to make a living writing and producing RPG material, that is no longer the. Odds of that being a viable business model are really stacked against you.
Well, I mean, and that kind of brings us to a harsh reality for our industry, is that the margins for these products are relatively narrow.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Very slim. You know, so many of the big name writers are doing this as a second job, which I was surprised about when I started looking to do writing work myself. I started talking to these people whose names I see on the cover of the book, and, you know, they tell me about their day job and tech support.
Exactly.
Yep, seems to be a common thread among writers. But it's like, yes. No, what are you talking about? You write for WotC. And they say, I write for WotC at night.
Yeah. Yep. A lot of the freelance RPGers are, their day jobs are, you know, or if they're really good writers, period, a lot of them move into actually writing fiction.
Yes, which, you know, may not be an outlet for them too much longer either.
Right. Well, yes. I'm just, my point being is that that's kind of what, you know, a lot of them would go on, or like, they go like, well, my day job, I'm a technical writer. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they move on to other things because, and that's, I mean, if you look at the history of game developers, you know, there are game developers during a certain time period, and then it's like, you don't hear from them again.
Yep.
And you wonder why, and it's like, they've gone on to a different job.
Yeah.
Where they can actually make money to support their family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to be a freelancer. And it's, even if you're not a freelancer, even if you're actually working for one of the industries, you may not be getting paid as much as you think you are. So
yeah, and you may not have a job that's very stable either. You know, we all know about the yearly Christmas layoffs.
Yep.
Right, exactly. So, all right. Well, thank you again, Blur RPG, for sending us that comment. I don't know. Again, we're not really sure how to take some of your comment, but we're just kind of responding to that.
But write us back if you're listening to us, because I'm a little curious about where you think some of this is coming from. I'd like to hear a little more background.
Yeah, and I'd actually kind of like to know where that number came from. I would love to see a published number for that. You know, I don't know, that whole reduction from 24 mil to 1.4 mil, because if that number's right, he's absolutely right. It doesn't make sense.
That would be a very scary thing. Yes, absolutely. So. But that doesn't, it's not what I experience. But then again, I only experience a very small portion of it. So it could be true. It's possible.
Well, that's us in general. We're all in that mode. We only experience just a tiny narrow bit.
Of course.
So our second audio comment. No, our second comment is, I think I copied this right, Gaelic Vigil.
That's a thing.
Yep. Concerning the segment about downtime, being a big one. big first edition AD&D fan. I actually follow time very precisely in my games. I usually DM games in a sandbox anyway, so I try to give my players the feeling that the world around them is living and breathing, moving along with or without their input. When I build worlds, after I created the map and factions that live in the world, I set up event timelines on what will eventually occur if the players don't impact the sequence of events. In essence, in my campaigns, much of the world's macro storyline has already been written. I'm daring the players to change the story by influence. In a way, I'm going back in time to see what they can do to manipulate the timeline I've created. So, for example, if the players start their game in a small village on the fifth month of lizards, I like that, fifth month of lizards, I have a kobold invasion set to happen on the 13th. The king may be murdered by a mysterious assassin on the 23rd, and a dragon to siege the nearby castle on the 30th. By doing this, it makes the world much more interesting and keeps the players on their toes to use their time wisely. I don't like playing feel like they live inside a vacuum where the rest of the world's inhabitants are simply automations waiting to be activated when the players walk past them. I want them to feel like they have no special birthright or entitlement to be heroes. They have to earn that title fair and square or die trying. Precise time management makes this possible. Wow, you know, that's very... I've never actually made timelines like that. That would be... I think for me, for most of my games, that would be a little hard.
I've done that to a certain degree, and we talked about a little bit about this last time, which is, of course, why he's commenting. Yeah. But that's, at least in this example, that's definitely that's not like a lot of prep work, and I commend you, sir. And I always know when my major events roughly are going to happen, but I'm not quite there. But you know what? I kind of want to play in your campaign. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, yeah.
Yeah, although I do want to just kind of point out from the downtime point of view that he starts it on the 5th, he has a major event on the 13th, another major event on the 23rd, and another major event on the 30th.
Sure.
There's no downtime scheduled there.
I was thinking that too, and of course it's an example, and he probably was using dates that are close together because it's an example. But if you're going to do something like that, and by writing things out, you almost want to do something like that because you think of a big world. There really is always something happening. But when you're talking about a story like this, you know, PCs are unlikely to ignore the event happening next door. Whereas in our lives, of course we do to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So you would want to spread that out, or else what's going to happen is you're going to go from level 1 to level 30 in a month.
Right. So, you know, I think that having this kind of timeline and having those events occur is awesome. And just my point with downtime is space them out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Put a few more weeks between each of those, or make it very clear that several of those events the PCs don't have to worry about.
Yes.
You know, the king is murdered by an assassin. You guys are not ever going to be allowed into court to investigate the assassination because you're not at that level yet. Mm-hmm. Just be aware that it happened.
Yep.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways what he's, you know, what you're referring to is that, you know, there's always background events, and I think sometimes we miss doing that.
Yep.
So, but yeah, that's that's very interesting. I like that. I do agree that it's hard though. That is a lot of prep work. It's kind of like, you know, can you plan the weather for the planet? You know what? I can't. But you know, it's interesting though. I just started running a Traveler game. And the interesting thing about Travelers, especially because of, you know, the way space travel works between planets, time becomes very important.
Yes.
Because, you know, weeks go by. You know, like a jump from one system to another takes a week. You know, just even in-system travel can take 3 to 4 days. You know, so actually using the calendar and marking it off is actually kind of important in that game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when I was reading this, that's the first thing that was popping in my mind. It's like, well, you know, recently I've been actually having to keep track of time. So
sure.
It's interesting in its own right because it's just, you know, I think sometimes players don't, and that, I mean, that's actually kind of a thing that we don't really involve a lot in players is like just even a simple calendar. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just, you know, we have 365 days and the first, you know, I don't know, 60 days or what is it? 4 divided by what's one? The first 90 days is winter, and the next 90 days is spring, and the next 90 days is summer, and the next 90 days is fall.
Sure.
You know, whatever. That becomes important because we don't, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes since you don't know what time it is, it almost seems like it's perpetually, I don't know, spring or something.
Yep. Yeah. No, I understand that. I had a 3.5. When I was playing 3.5, at one point I got really frustrated with that, and I actually rolled out, because they had weather tables, the weather for 90 days, because I wanted to use weather in battle, but I didn't just want it to be like, oh, we're fighting drought, so it's raining today. I wanted it to sort of be a random event and make it more dynamic. And boy, did I forget to reference that chart all the time.
Yes.
So.
And one of the few things that's really helped me keep track of time is, oddly enough, Obsidian Portal. I don't know how many people are familiar with this site. It's basically a free campaign wiki you can use. And one of the things that's on there is basically the ability to do these blog post style front page. And we use it for campaign notes. And because you can date them, but you can really control the date, I've used that function to control, to not mark the date when I posted it, but mark the dates where things have happened. And I start each one by figuring out the season. I post the season right on top. And that's really helped me to keep that continuity. And of all the things that Obsidian Portal does, just that simple thing I found really helpful.
Well, I'm sure Mike will be very proud that you mentioned him. By the way, I've met him twice. He's a very nice guy.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of interviews with him.
Yeah,
every time I've heard him speak, he seems like a good guy.
He's an interesting cat, to say the least. I still love when he accepted his award, not last year, but the year before in 2010, he kind of had this Road Warrior theme going on for the Innies.
Mm-hmm.
So I forget what that was all about, whether that was like a bet or something with one of his friends. Interesting cat, though. So anyway, again, Gaelic Vigil, thank you for that comment. Hopefully next time around we'll get some people to send us some audio ones. I love the audio ones, but you know, if you want to hear me flub your written comment, go ahead and write it. I have no problem with that either. You know, I'm horrible at reading. You know, I have to as for full disclosure, I have a script that I sort of use, but it's more of a reference than what I actually say. Because it's like, I'm horrible at reading text. It's like, okay, I would be horrible as a news person that has had to read a teleprompter. I'd be horrible at that. So if you would like to go ahead and send us some comments, you can do that in a variety of ways. We have, of course, an email. You can send it to us at info@rpgcircus.com. You can leave us a voicemail, and we would love a voicemail from you at 1-888-643-6322. That is 1-888-643-6322. You can Twitter us at RPG Circus. You can go to our Facebook page for RPG Circus and post something on the wall. You can also post something at the RPG Table Talk forum. And, of course, you know, you can just, when we do the blog post, you can just put a comment. That's where these two came from. So, any way you want to do it, we're more than happy to do that. Do we have any closing comments before we sign off?
No, buy Kobold Quarterly 19.
Yeah, so there you go, folks. Buy I can't even pronounce it today. Yep, it's time for us to go. That's what it is.
It's time to go.
Right.
So we will hopefully see you guys in 2 weeks, unless I decide to do it sooner, depending on our schedule. The preceding podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.